Next, I want to look at employment status criteria. The employer or contractor must decide the correct status when the worker is first taken on or engaged. The fact that the worker has been self-employed before may not be decisive. It may not determine the issue. The terms of the specific engagement are crucial. Self-employed status does not automatically transfer from one contract to another. Workers can be self-employed under one contract for services, whilst being employed under another contract of service with different contractual terms and conditions. Frequently in the past, I used to demonstrate this to AAT members by saying, as an employee of PKF, standing up lecturing, I was an employee. But providing my services to the AAT, Tollies and others on a self-employed basis, I was doing the same work, but I was self-employed. The courts have developed a two-stage test for deciding the employment status of a worker. First, looking at the irreducible minimum of providing personal service and the existence of mutuality of obligation. The issue of personal service is where we see lots of questions about providing substitute workers, especially in an IR 35 situation. Providing substitute workers, or at least being able to provide a substitute, where some decisions of the courts have indicated that it must therefore be self-employment when a substitute can be provided. The mutuality point is whether the employer is obliged to provide work and whether the worker is obliged to accept the work. The casual workers in the banqueting suite of the former Trusthouse Forte Hotel Group were held not to be employed earners because there was no mutuality of obligation. To the man in the street, that might seem a surprising result, where I'm sure they would think casual waitresses would be employees. AAT members would be familiar with the argument in the construction industry. The contractors are not obliged to provide work or pay self-employed subcontractors when bad weather closes the site or there just isn't any work. Quite a few cases have been decided in favour of the contractors on the argument of lack of mutuality of obligation. The second of the two-stage test generally applied by the courts is to look at other key factors which may determine the employment status of the worker. These key factors tended to be concentrated on by the revenue in the past, but in all fairness, the ESI test now does look at some of these factors and does take them into account. The control test has often been regarded as the most important and brings us back to the question as to whether there is a master-servant relationship. The higher the degree of control by the engager, the more likely it is that we have an employment. Conversely, the absence of any control or the lack of much control by the engager is more likely to lead to a decision of self-employment. Next, we have the integration test, sometimes called the part and parcel test, which seeks to establish if the worker has become part and parcel of the organisation and must therefore be an employee. A quote from one of the tax cases says, "The more integrated the person is, or the more work is an integral part of the business, the more likely he is to be considered an employee." This was Cassidy versus the Ministry of Health as long ago as 1951. But a more recent case, the case of the Ready Mix Concrete Company, suggested the test raised more questions than answers. But be warned, HMRC officers are asking workers when they interview them if they are part and parcel of the organisation. Yes, HMRC officers may actually go to the homes of workers and interview them and not tell the engager or employer that. The business or economic reality test can be important, asking if the worker is in business on his or her own account. If the answer is yes, the worker should be accepted as self-employed, providing their services through that business. So we should always look for evidence of the existence of a real business. The provision of all the necessary equipment, facilities, etc. by the engager, not by the worker, will be seen by HMRC as a pointer to employment. Again, conversely, the provision of significant equipment by the worker will point to self-employment, with small hand tools being ignored. It is difficult to draw a line as to when the provision of equipment adds up to self-employment and when it's insufficient to add up to self-employment. In the case of Hall versus Lorimer, Mr. Lorimer, who was a vision mixer in the film industry, did not provide any premises, any tools, any equipment or workshop. He did the work in the studios using their equipment. But he was held to be self-employed on the balance of all the facts. This was mainly because of the number of separate engagements that he had with different studios. So Lord Justice Mummery and his colleagues thought he was self-employed. HMRC's ESI appears to place a large emphasis on the taking of financial risk, which might include investment in financing equipment, materials, tools, vehicles, etc. Having to tender and compete for the work, payment on a fixed price basis, having a share of the profit, being exposed to the risk of making good, bad work at their own expense, and of bearing the additional costs of overruns, all point towards the risk of self-employment. This contrasts sharply with workers paid hourly or daily for all the hours or days worked. I don't want you to accept that hourly or daily rates means employment. I will argue that workers paid hourly or daily can still profit by completing the work early, and they may suffer loss by working longer to finish the task. Many only get paid when there is work available. What about the length and number of engagements? There is no statutory guidance on this, but in some industries, like the TV and film industry, HMRC use a 9-month rule for certain categories of workers. I've seen some status officers try to apply a 12-month rule. In other words, if a self-employed freelancer, consultant, etc., only works for one engager over a 12-month period, they must be an employee. But that's rubbish. Some freelancers, IT workers, and even CIS subcontractors may work for the same business for years. And if they're generally self-employed on day one of the contract, I would ask, what effect does time have on the contract? However, having said that, I'm always concerned about what I call employment creep. No, not that colleague you work with, but the way contractual arrangements might change without being noticed. Are there separate contracts of limited duration, say 6-month fixed contracts? How often are the contractual arrangements reviewed and checks made to confirm that the self-employed worker has not become an employee, has not been provided with employee rights and or benefits? This is a point that does need to be watched, because certainly HMRC officers will be looking at it, and maybe with the benefit of hindsight, they'll be able to argue for employment.